Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had a while back with Gary Swart. Gary is a general partner with Polaris Ventures, a VC firm in the Bay Area. Prior to that, he was a CEO at Odesk, which is now called Upwork. And he has just some great thoughts to share around managing your career and leadership. And we're looking forward to today's conversation with Gary. And it's great to have Gary joining us from the Bay Area and definitely looking forward to our conversation.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess first off, Gary, can you give us just a little bit of your background, just a little bit of your story?
Sure. I went to school on the East Coast, grew up in New Jersey, actually went to school at University of Maryland, and then went into manufacturing out of college, which was not a great move. That was an industry that was going the wrong way. And so I quickly transitioned into tech. I went to work for a little company called Pure Software out here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Pure was just a rocket ship. So company went public in the mid-90s, a whole series of mergers and acquisitions, and ultimately became part of IBM. Mm. So I had the good fortune of starting as employee number 25 and then ending as employee number 131,000 at Big Blue over an eight-year period. I then went to a little company called IntelliBank, which I like to say was Dropbox done wrong, and that was a character building experience. And then I ended up running a company called Odesk, now Upwork. Upwork is the world's largest talent marketplace. It's a $6 billion company today, which I saw from the beginning. It's just really hard to believe, even seeing it today. And then I transitioned out of there about 6 years ago and joined a venture capital firm called Polaris Partners. So I've had an operating career now investor 30 years.
Great. Well, I like to ask this question of almost every guest that we have is, knowing what you know now, if you were able to go back and talk to a 22-year-old Gary, what advice would you give him?
Oh my gosh. And how much time do we have, Mark? So much advice. You've heard all of the, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, all of these things. Sure. And now what you realize is experience is what you get when you don't get all the other things you want. And so my advice is don't squander that experience. Like the things that I look back on probably most favorably are some of the hard problems that we solved at Odesk. Coming back from vacation earlier because our international banking relationship was blowing up, or because we had massive fraud, or something happened in the business that at the time, you were begging to get out of. But it's those experiences where you learn the most, where you're problem solving. And so my advice would be never squander a good crisis, right? Learn as much as you can. And that makes you who you are today.
Is there any advice early on that you wish you would have ignored?
I got a lot of advice when I look back, and I probably need counseling over this, but a lot of people telling you can't do it. Oh yeah, no, you could never do that. Yeah, you're not. No, that's a stretch for you. And like listening to that negative feedback as opposed to just doing it, just getting out there and doing it. And when I look back early in my career, I was probably held back by people saying you can't do that. And to all of those people, I'd like to just have a nice big F you shout out because I think not listening to the negative voices.
Sure. And think back to that first time that you inherited a team or had to build out a team. What do you wish you would have known as far as going into that first leadership? We have a number of new and up and coming leaders that listen to this podcast. What would you say to them?
Well, yeah, you're not watching video, so you can't see me, but I'm smiling ear to ear because when I was at Pure Software, I was a sales rep, and I was a top sales rep a couple of years in a row, and I was very competitive, and I had a mentality of sort of I win, you lose. Like, I had to win, even at the expense of, relationships on the team, right? And that's what I thought good sales was. It was you have a quota and you crush that quota. And then I'll never forget the CEO of the company came to me and said, hey, we want you to be a manager. And the CEO was a gentleman by the name of Reed Hastings. And some may recognize that name. Reed now is the CEO, or he was recently stepped down as the CEO of a little movie company called Netflix. And Pure was Reed's first company. He came to me, he said, look, we want you to be a manager. We want you to be a sales manager. You're going to take these 15 people who are your peers, and we want you to manage those people and build the team. And I said, Reed, why would I do that? Like, I'm doing great at my job and like, I love my job. Like, why? Like, I don't want to manage people. And he's like, yeah, we really need you to do this. And so, you know, the one thing is I always say, put yourself in a position to say no. Like, do such a good job that you get tapped on the shoulder to get the next job. And I'm not trying to round my shoulders, but I've built a career of doing that. So anyway, here I am. I'm now the manager of, you know, 15 or 16 people that were formerly my peers. And I was horrible, Mark. I was horrible. Like, I thought that my job was to, Reed told me, teach these people to do what you can do. So I thought they were supposed to do it like me. And what I didn't realize is that you have 16 people with 16 different personalities and everybody wasn't me, but I was trying to teach them to be me, you know, act exactly like me. And it took me a while to figure out that to motivate people, you have to recognize that they're different. People have different strengths, different styles. And I would say that that's an evolution that just takes time. So my guidance, long answer, is recognize that everybody's not like you and it takes many different types to build a successful team, not all of one type. And that was probably my biggest mistake.
Yeah, it's one of the pieces of advice we give people is a lot of times you have the tendency to want to hire people that are just like you, and that doesn't typically work. Talk a little bit about your philosophy. I was looking at one of your articles that was in LinkedIn from some time ago, and it had a great visual of kind of your hiring philosophy and what you look for in candidates. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this I learned over, you know, many years later about what makes a good employee and what you owe employees and the like to keep them motivated, engaged. But what I found was it, when I look back, you know, I had the good fortune of hiring many hundreds of people and firing lots of people, unfortunately, as well. And when I looked at the characteristics or the things that made employees successful or unsuccessful, it sort of boiled down to four things. It's personal characteristics. Who is the person? It's motivation. What is it that they want out of this job and out of career and out of life in general? It's skills. What skills and expertise do they have? And it's knowledge. What do they know? Different from skills. So consider that sort of like domain expertise. So are they coming from a similar business? Do they have a deep background in what it is that you're doing or hiring for? And what I found is that most people put the emphasis on the skill and the knowledge. When I was running Odesk, people would come to me and say, oh my gosh, we have to hire this person. They come from eBay. So they have marketplace experience and we're a marketplace and eBay is much bigger than us. Therefore, we should hire this person. Oh, and by the way, they already have marketing skill or marketplace skills around this domain expertise. But what I found was the most important things are the personal characteristics first and the motivation second. Personal characteristics, think of the core values or what does that person value? What adjectives would you use to describe that person? And are those aligned with the culture that you're building or what you're looking for at your company? And of course, the skill and the knowledge are maybe table stakes. You're not going to hire a controller who doesn't have a CPA degree. That's table stakes to get in the door. And if they happen to work at a similar business, that's nice too. But they have to have the personal characteristics. And the motivation is important for the long term. If somebody's looking for something that you can't offer at your company, then you're probably better off just not even going down that path in the first place, because it's just going to be a waste of time. They're not going to be happy. You're not going to be happy. You're going to turn over that employee and you're going to be back recruiting and hiring within 12, 14 months. And you just can't afford to do that. So I say put emphasis on the you mentioned a pyramid. It's a personal characteristics on the top, motivation in the middle, skill and knowledge off to the side, in that priority order.
Yeah, I heard you interviewed talking about how that sometimes somebody that maybe is an entrepreneur, they'll bring in their first salesperson and they can waste about 9 months of their time because they take 3 months to find the person, 3 months to get them up to speed. And then finding those clients or people that are going to purchase it or the product. And I thought that was interesting that a lot of times people don't think through that and kind of what are the important things that we need to make sure we hit as far as in the people that we hire.
I'm a big fan of the back channel reference also. You may think you know what the core values of the candidate are, but back channel referencing with somebody who has worked with them in the past and saying, is this person smart, hardworking, creative, trustworthy, high integrity, you know, whatever adjectives you want to use to describe. And I remember I called a good friend of mine who happened to be the chief people officer at a company where this employee had worked before. And I said, how, you know, would you hire this person again? And she said, absolutely. This person was an egg. And she said, as a matter of fact, now that I know he's on the market, I'm just going to tell you that we're probably going to go after him and try and hire him back.
Yeah.
So she said, sorry to do that to you, but he's that good.
Sure.
And then I said, tell me a little bit more. What kind of a manager was he? She said he was a good manager, good leader. And she said, hiring, I'd say he was better than 50-50 odds. And I said, well, I certainly would hope so. And she said, Gary, our best managers are not 50-50. So, Mark, to your point, flip a coin when you hire a salesperson. It's 50-50 odds that you're actually going to get a good one. So anything you can do to maximize your odds in your favor will save you a lot of time and money and headaches.
Talk a little bit about that moving from being somebody that is calling the shots, an operator on a day-to-day basis, then moving into the VC world. What were some things that you learned about that through that? And I think I read one of your other articles that you talked about venture capital and curling. And I thought that was kind of an interesting analogy.
Yeah, the analogy there is that you're like the little guys, the sweepers, the guys with the brooms who are clearing the ice for the person rolling the puck down the ice. But you can't touch the puck. Like you're, you know, oftentimes I'll say you're a passenger in the car. You can't grab the wheel. Mm-hmm. You can forcefully try and say, hey, I think you should go right. But at the end of the day, the person driving the car has to decide which way they go. And I know from running a company, I hated it when my board members or advisors tried to grab the wheel. I just didn't appreciate it. And I know that entrepreneurs feel the same way. So you have to shift from being, the driver to the passenger. And I'm not saying in the back seat with your mouth shut. You can be in the front seat. You can add value. You can work, say, let me handle music or maps or rest stops or whatever it is. You know, let me help in the journey. But I'm not driving. Or oftentimes I'll say actor and director. You know, I've acted and now I'm no longer acting. I'm now directing movies. So but you have to get comfortable with that because it's hard, right? It's hard to, as you said, you know, you're calling the shots and now you're not calling the shots, right? You're playing a supporting role.
So the new leader, maybe a new CEO who is now has a board, I think that's probably one of the misconceptions is that some people think, well, now I'm the CEO, I'm the boss, and then they don't realize they also have a board that they're working with. What advice would you give someone maybe working with a board for the first time?
You know, it's interesting you say that. Somebody told me this pretty early on. They said, you know, first and foremost, your number one job is don't run out of money. And then they said, you also have to recognize that the board's primary job is to hire and fire the CEO. And I didn't even think about that. And then all of a sudden, that's the reality. And you all of a sudden, you realize that, yeah, you're the boss, but you have a board that can remove the boss if they so choose to. So I think that's important to note. For entrepreneurs, you know, I think it's having a good relationship with your board. It's open, honest, it's transparent. The best relationships I have and the ones that I appreciate the most are where the CEOs are coachable, they listen. At the end of the day, they make the decision, but they take your input under advisement, right? They seek opinions. They want to know how you think about it. And they do it in a way where their mind isn't made up yet. the ones that are saying, hey, I want your opinion on this, but you already know that their mind is made up, because most of the time they're trying to sell you on why they're doing that as opposed to listening. So I think it's really leveraging your board to your advantage. And the other relationships I appreciate the most are the ones where they're just brutally honest. It's like, here's what's going well, but let me tell you what's not going well. And what I don't like are surprises. You know, when somebody, a CEO, a team knows something and they don't share it with you and they try and hide it. And by the time you find out about it, you're like, you know, if you told me this 6 weeks ago, we could have helped. Like, there's things we could do. So I'm really big on transparency. I love a monthly update, and it doesn't have to be detailed, just a paragraph about here's what's working, here's what's not working, here's what we're going to do next month, next quarter, whatever it is. And then you could say, look, if you want to double click on anything below this line, I've written a longer summary, but this is the highlight. And that to me is the best. I have some CEOs that are exceptional at it, and others have been trying to coach to do it, but they want to drive to the left. They want to drive down the middle of the road. So, but I think that's the best thing you could do is not use the board meetings for that information sharing. Share that information in a cadence and a format that's not too onerous, but really transparent, open, and honest.
So is there any lessons that you've learned? We're all experiencing a strange time in our history with the last 10, 11 months that we've experienced. Any lessons that you've learned during this last year that you think, or that you're seeing in other leaders that they're doing maybe right or wrong during this time?
Well, on the right side, you know, it's recognizing that life goes on, right? Yes, the landscape has changed. Yes, we're mostly remote where we were mostly on premise. The ones that like took control right away and they said, okay, first things first, we've got to reduce the burn. We've got to be fair to people. So, you know, a lot of companies had to downsize, right? And that was in order to make the companies successful. And they did that in a humane way. People got severance, people got introduced for other jobs and the like. But I appreciate that as opposed to keeping people on at the risk of the company when it wasn't fair to them and not fair to the rest of the team. So like holding high standards. Also people who took control and recognized that, hey, the world is going to be different. And it's not just, hey, we were on premise and now we're remote, but it's what are we going to do to make remote better? Right? What things can we do? How can we get people connected? How can we keep people engaged? How can we keep people motivated? And I've seen some unbelievably creative things, you know, I mean, beyond happy hour, you know, but sure, really a going above and beyond for the employees. And then there's just some basic block and tackle. You know, if you're going to do things, you have, whether you're online or you're on site, you have to do certain things culturally in order to thrive. And first and foremost is to have clarity as to where the company's going and how it's going to get there. Paramount. And it's even more important in this new world than it ever was before. People have to feel connected to, and they have to know what it is. So, you know, do you have a clear and inspiring vision? Does everybody know where you're going? Does everybody know how you're going to get there? The second thing that you need to emphasize is who's responsible for what. This is important when everybody's in the office. It's even more important when people are somewhat disconnected, right? Does everybody know who's doing what? And then people need to know how everyone's being measured. And the clarity around that, where you're going, how you're going to get there, who's doing what, and does everybody know how everybody else is being measured? Right? What are the metrics that are important? And does sales know how marketing is being measured? And does marketing know how the CEO is being measured? And they, it seems really basic, but having this clarity in these times is more important than ever before.
What, any books that you would say you definitely put on a list for leaders that maybe have had an impact on your life that you'd recommend to others?
You know, I first became a CEO. My wife bought me a handful of books because I'd never been a CEO. And they were little short reads. I think the author is Lencioni. Is it Lencioni? Pat Lencioni?
Yep. Pat, right.
Yep. Yeah. and they were really quick reads. And I have to say that they were phenomenal. Like, you know, I plowed through them. And then, you know, I was the CEO for a couple of months, and then I reread them all, and I realized all the mistakes I was making, despite the fact that I read the book. And so right. I kept them on my shelf and referred back to them over the years. I have a bookshelf behind me. They're not on there. I think I gifted them to somebody else along the way and never got them back. And then some other books that have, you know, that I've really enjoyed and have really sort of inspired me. And like one was Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. And just the trials and tribulations, the fact that, you know, Nike was like one of these 20-year overnight success stories. Like they were so close to going out of business. Not spoiler alert if you haven't read it. But it's fascinating to hear how he just kept, you know, it was a lot of luck and timing and hard work and perseverance. And so that book was always inspiring to me. And then one of my early colleagues wrote a book. So we worked together, Pure Software. We acquired his company. He became head of marketing for Pure and then Pure Atria. And then he was the co-founder of Netflix. His name is Mark Randolph. And he wrote a book called That Will Never Work. And I recommend it to all of my entrepreneurs because he's just, one, he's such a fabulous storyteller. But similar to Shoe Dog, you realize that Netflix was not obvious. It was not an obvious. It is today, right?
Sure.
The benefit of hindsight. But at the time, it was not. Like DVDs by mail? Come on. And the number of people that told him that will never work. And so that book to me has lessons well beyond Netflix. It's just phenomenal entrepreneur and startup advice. So I would say those three books have been, or more than three, those books have been transformational.
Sure. Yeah. Well, no, Blockbuster was growing up, going to the Blockbuster was it. That was the only model that you thought of, and definitely has changed considerably over that time. But so you're in the heart of technology. You've worked in the technology field with investments and in others. But is there any technology that you has made you more effective?
Well, I mean, all the obvious answers, you know, clearly my iPhone and the myriad of apps that I use, you know, apps I love. I love Strava for working out. And there's just certain, Waze for transportation and just some like I couldn't exist without today. When I look at the ones that I truly use on a regular basis. And then of course, Zoom, you know, the obvious, but to me, the mind-boggling thing about Zoom is we've been using WebEx and GoToMeeting and BlueJeans. There were so many different iterations along the way. Even Google, the Google Meeting, like there's plenty of video technology, but Zoom is just one of these. You hit a button and magic happens. Mm-hmm. And that's what people expect today. You know, you want speed, quality, and price, and you want it now. And I just, I love the apps where you hit a button and magic happens on the back end.
Yeah, absolutely. So outside of work, what do you do to recharge?
Well, I used to say, you know, when I was running a company, which by the way, I have a tremendous amount of empathy for entrepreneurs out there. I mean, everybody works hard, right? But entrepreneurs, it's truly lonely at the top and the buck stops with you. And that's the part of the job I didn't like. And I used to tell people that, you know, there's work, there's family, and there's exercise, you know, it's like, what do you do in your spare time besides work and family? And everything suffered when I was a CEO, you know, because I was working, I don't want to say so hard. I was working so much, you know, it's always consuming that I was disconnected on vacations. I gained some weight. I wasn't as fit as I wanted to be. And so, now I think I'm a little bit more dedicated to the family, and I'm definitely more dedicated to activities outside of work. And so, you know, I love the outdoors. I love to surf, the beach, the mountains, biking, that kind of thing, swimming. So, and my latest obsession is pickleball. If you haven't played, it's a blast.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing more people talk about pickleball lately than ever. So yeah, I told you so that you could rub it in that we're 1 degree here in Minnesota today. So, you know, we're I can relate more to the curling story than I can to, to pickleball or surfing. So what parting advice would you give to a new and up and coming leader?
Oh my gosh. Well, I think, you know, what we talked about before on hiring, focusing on the personal characteristics, the motivation, the skill, and the knowledge. The second thing is picking a major. You know, it's having clarity as to where you're going. And, you know, when I look back on my career, I mentioned IntelliBank was a little startup. I left IBM to help start. And we didn't know what we wanted to be when we grew up. We didn't have a major. And when you don't have a major, you can't minor in everything. And so we learned that the hard way. And then the last piece of advice is around, what do you owe your employees? You know, you, of course you owe them that clarity and a good work environment, but you owe the people that work with you the opportunity to make an impact. And that's an impact to your customers and to your investors, but even better if it's an impact to the world, if you're doing something meaningful. The second thing you owe them is the opportunity for personal and professional growth and development. Right? Like you, they're going to leave if they don't feel like they're on a steep learning curve. That's why I left IBM. I like the company. I like the people around me. I just didn't feel like I was going to learn enough. My growth curve was flat, not steep. The third thing is financial reward. Of course, you have to pay people for the work they're doing. And even better if they can be incented to share in the rewards of the company via equity. And are you going to win in a big way when this company is successful thanks to their hard work? And then the fourth thing is balance, which we talked about. It's having some balance in your life and recognizing, somebody just told me, I spoke to an entrepreneur who I'm advising a little bit on Friday, and he said he was going to Hawaii for a week, and he said, I'm not going to tell anybody because I just feel a little bit. And I'm like, number one, you should tell people. Number two, you're not going to Hawaii for a vacation. Yes, you're going to have some sun and a little bit of downtime, but are you telling me you're not bringing your laptop? He goes, no, of course I'm bringing my laptop. Guy's going to be working the whole time. So nobody's going to begrudge you that week that you took off. And when I look back at Odesk, I mean, I was entitled to some time off. I didn't feel like I could take it. It was because I was trying to lead by example to the extreme. And you have to have some balance in your life. So impact, growth and development, financial reward and balance. And what you owe your employees is what you also owe yourself. So everybody should make sure that they're actually achieving those things in their career. And if they're not, they should figure out how they can. And that may mean hiring a CEO over you and you move into chairman, or surrounding yourself with more people, or leaving your company in capable hands and going starting another one, right? It's making sure that you're checking those boxes for yourself as well.
Well, Gary, I sure appreciate you taking some time out to talk to us today. And I know this is going to be helpful to those that listen. You're doing some great work.
Awesome, Mark. Great to chat with you. I look forward to meeting again soon.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.